Tonight on Coast to Coast, we talk about electronic voice phenomena, instrumental transcommunication as well. Special guest, Dr. Stephen Rourke, and this one is next on Coast to Coast AM. Dr. Stephen Rourke has lectured on developmental psychology, cognition, theoretical and applied physics, and EVP, electronic voice phenomena. Dr. Rourke proposes best evidence standards in paranormal research, and he leads the way with his conclusive investigation of the enduring Spiracom mystery. Dr. Stephen Rourke has advocated for nearly a decade that the role of science should be to investigate the unexplained, not explained the uninvestigated. I like that, Stephen. I like that indeed. How are you?
Great, George. Good to be here.
You too. Tell me a little bit about your background beyond just what I went through.
Well, I have an academic background. I've got experience as a professor of physics for Loyola College, instructed Masters of Science courses at the university level. I've got undergraduate, graduate, and doctoral degrees, and I'm currently pursuing postdoctoral research in the cognitive sciences, which only kind of sort of overlaps with this side interest that we're presenting this evening. I've lectured on the EVP itself, but also developmental psychology and cognition and theoretical and applied physics. So these most recent studies have brought that academic acumen really to bear upon the EVP-ITC mystery and its claims of best evidence in the form of Spiracom.
Now, how did a scientist who deals with hard science get involved in the supernatural end of things?
It was kind of in a roundabout way. It's one of these very serendipitous things. As a child, I had found a book on my grandfather's bookshelf, and reading it as a child, it had these wild claims, and I assumed that this book had to be a work of fiction, and it was, in fact, the book by Peter Bander called Voices from the Tapes, Recordings from the Other World. And so it's about the EVP phenomenon, and it's got these strange characters like Dr. Konstantin Raudova having thousands of documented examples of anomalous voices on tape, and the nod from the Catholic Church giving approval in stark contrast to disapproval to things like Ouija boards. The Catholic Church in this book was giving the nod to mediumship of the tape recorder. So I found all this so strange as a child, I thought to myself, gee, it must be a work of fiction, only to come later years in college, only to come to the realization that EVP was, in fact, a recognized phenomenon, mm-hmm. an anomalous phenomenon in the circles of paranormal enthusiasts.
So you decided, as you got into the degreed end of things and then into your life work, you're going to investigate this stuff.
Yeah, because, you know, a person is only given two choices, essentially, when we do the side picking. You know, it's very intellectually dishonest to either completely dismiss something because it seems outlandish, right? So much of the world is until it's fully understood. And it's equally intellectually dishonest to simply agree with something because it comports with your worldview. So I decided to do neither and engage in testing the evidence. And that's what brought me directly to the Spiracom story, because the Spiracom story is one that purports to present on audio tape documented two-way conversation, not just EVP snippets, to be clear, documented two-way conversation with a deceased NASA scientist by way of a technological device. And those are the claims. And with claims like that and its imminent testability in the way of all those audio tapes of the sessions between the operator of the EVP-ITC device and the supposed discarnate scientist, I figured this made it the perfect case to test those best evidence standards.
I'm looking forward to this tonight, Stephen. You know, you and I parallel somewhat because unlike going into the science end as you did to get these answers to some of these unexplained events, I went into broadcasting with a lifelong interest since I was a kid in broadcasting and the paranormal. But I, Stephen, went into broadcasting so I could talk to people like you who are in the know to fulfill that need that I had, because I figured there's no way I can just pick up the phone and call you, for example, and talk with you about what you're doing and the kind of work you're doing. But if I was in broadcasting, I'd have a great opportunity to do that. So that's the direction I went.
You know, I see your point. It's a really an overarching and very broad one to discuss people's frameworks for understanding the world. And that's really important because I don't necessarily seek to change anyone's heart or mind, just to present the evidence, put it out there in the open forum of ideas about this kind of phenomena and let folks make up their own mind.
Did you go into this with an open mind? Did you go into this with any kind of biasness? How did you do it?
Well, I have to admit I do have a rational scientific bent. So, if someone did have a framework for understanding their world, George, let's say like a very spiritual or religious framework, they might be more inclined to adopt a set of conclusions as beliefs that are kind of maybe extra cognitive that they hadn't entirely thought through. But this is the nature of that framework of understanding. It's not to be critical of it. I'm stating a fact. So I have to concede that my framework for understanding the world is skeptical, but not as a debunker. This is
okay. So you didn't go into this to debunk these things. You went into this to find out what they are with a real answer, whatever it is.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, and far from being a debunker, I have spoken on both the problematic aspects of EVP. They're truncated, really very, very brief, that they're open to broad interpretation. These are all the problems with EVP. But I've also lectured on EVP as an extremely compelling data set that begs for academic interdisciplinary attention to resolve it as an enduring mystery and a phenomenon. So far from being a debunker, I would put me clearly in the skeptic camp, but that is not to say I set out to disprove something. Otherwise, I'd be intellectually dishonest in selecting evidence that fit my worldview. I'd be doing the same exact thing that I'm saying folks have been doing regarding EVP, ITC, and Spiritcom.
Starting next half hour, Stephen, we'll start playing some of these clips that you provided for us, and I'll let you explain them as we go along with them. Give me your scientific interpretation of EVP, electronic voice phenomena.
Well, there are a few different theories out there, so I can share my pet interpretation at the end, but it's best to give everyone some context.
Sure.
So EVP could be, for folks who aren't familiar, just first, a catch-all for EVP. If you understood it as the anomalous appearance of voices on recording medium. And later, these sounds are interpreted as meaningful snippets of speech. That's EVP. And ITC, which is instrumental transcommunication, that's just the broader overarching area of endeavor where people use technology to explore mystical and ethereal realms. Okay. So with that in mind, EVP itself is that almost two-dimensional aspect of ITC. It's just the voices on the tape or digital medium. So with that being said, clearly EVP, sounds that appear to be voices showing up on tapes, let's say, that could be an extension of human potential. I mean, it could be a kind of telekinesis thing, I suppose. That's one possible explanation for it. I admit that strains a given kind of credulity to say that someone could be impressing with their mind the sounds on a tape. Second one could be that it's not so much hauntings or ghosts responsible for these things, but let's say by your interacting in a given environment, almost like an electrostatic cling, this EVP is being played back because of your interaction with a given environment at a given time. Now, it could also be that there's this intelligent two-way communication happening. And Coast has had some folks on, like Brendan Cook from GIS, and they appear to be getting, probably from as a direct result of their sheer number of EVPs, they have a variety in their data set that shows apparent interaction. So this brings it beyond this idea of just being in a playback of a given atmospheric condition or something that we just don't understand. And then going toward the much more theoretical, but since this is all very theoretical anyway, I suppose it's okay to mention it.
It sure is.
It could be that EVP provides evidence for higher compactified dimensions where, let's say, either post-fourth-dimensional beings, okay, that's a scientific term for dead people, post-fourth-dimensional beings might inhabit and be able to communicate with the lower dimensions, much like the Michio Kaku example of, you know, the carp in the pond wouldn't know of these higher dimensions, and yet we outside of the pond can easily communicate with the fish, you see. So it would be that same kind of thinking. And so that's my personal favorite, is to pursue that Everett's many worlds interpretation. And then almost on the flip side of that multiple dimensions, multiple universes coin to explain EVP is the idea that it doesn't necessarily have to be a string theory kind of interpretation where you've got these many, many, many worlds and everything's always splitting and forking and there's some infinite universes at all times in the multiverse. It could be that these voices, let's say, are coming from smaller, lower compactified dimensions that exist just, you know, millimeters from us. So all this being completely theoretical.
Okay, now, and we'll get into all these, but you do accept the fact that whatever they are and wherever they're from, there seems to be actual sounds that are being recorded that are very unusual. Would you agree with that?
Oh, yes, and that's what
makes it. It's not all fraud. People aren't in their little audio rooms playing around with the tapes all the time. That some of this is real. We just don't know what it is.
Oh, yeah. In fact, if you consider just how many examples of EVP there are, I at one point did a statistical study where, and I just ran out of the ability to document how many are out there. It seems that it would be impossible for all of these to be faked, because the amount of time it takes to consider them among a group and post them on a site, to add to that someone would be faking them in real time or before the fact in some sort of a hoaxing operation, it seems impossible, because there are literally hundreds of thousands just on the web. That is to say nothing of those that exist on tapes people haven't found, those that exist elsewhere that people have found and not posted. There are hundreds of thousands of examples of anomalous audio that sounds like speech. And this is an important distinction, though, I will say, because people are, you know, pattern recognizing and sense making creatures, and so sometimes we can, through what's called apophenia or auditory pareidolia, like children see dragons in clouds, we can use this complex pattern recognition system to sometimes believe something isn't there, something is there when it isn't. But that being said, I do think that there's a vast data set of EVPs that demand a hard look.
Can you imagine the headlines here?
Oh, boy.
Scientist believes that EVPs are real. Now, I don't know what the story will say, because we haven't decided yet, nor have we concluded where they're coming from. But the headline alone is worth a major story, Stephen.
Hey, that's really wild you brought that up, because that kind of headline reminds me of the you've heard of the Edison story, right? About the Edison attempt to communicate with the
dead. I know he was trying to develop a machine for that. Yes.
Right, and that's a great example of how a headline, and just what you picked up on, how a headline can fuel a mythos that underwrites a story that might have reality to it, but the mythology ends up becoming the story.
Yes.
We could address that Scientific American article where it's basically framed as Edison's attempt to communicate with the dead. This article has given rise to the Spiricom project. Again, this Spiricom project, just to revisit that quickly, from the mid-1960s to the early 1980s, research on the development of a technological means of communication. So to be clear, this is not like spirit mediumship or something in the ordinary sense. Technological means of communication with the dead was conducted by this Meta Science Foundation Incorporated. And George W. Meek, the president of MetaScience, who funded, he was the benefactor, he received funding from other sources, but traveled the world looking for answers, ultimately used a lot of his own money on these experiments. He was influenced heavily by this article about Edison's attempt to communicate with the dead. And, of course, it's rational to be influenced by an article like that if you read the subtitle, because you're thinking, hey, if Edison was looking into it, this brilliant man, you know, maybe the rest of us should consider it. And more contemporary things like Frank's Box, which I know you've had details about that on your show.
Yes.
Frank's Box is another kind of telephone to the dead Spiricom-like device that was influenced by this Edison story. In fact, one of the proponents of Frank's Box, his name is Chris Moon, he claims upon the advice of Edison himself, you know, today, his communication through this Frank's Box with Edison, he claims that that there are all sorts of mandates to communication with the ethereal realms and all this. So this single Scientific American article about Edison's attempt to communicate with the dead has given birth to the EVP-ITC movement. Now, I know that there might have been people technically fiddling with devices earlier than that, but I'm talking about the mythology surrounding EVP-ITC. This was a seminal article. However, there's a little problem with the article. Most folks have not gone to the microfiche,
right,
and read the actual article. In the article about Edison's attempt to communicate with the dead, a careful read shows that Edison made no such claims. See, in the article, Edison is merely responding, like most scientists do, like your questions about EVP, he's responding in hypothetical terms to the reporter's line of inquiry. And a careful read shows that there was no indication, really no reason, to conclude that he was personally engaged in an effort to build a device to communicate with the dead. The impression one gets from the article, by the way, George, is like, imagine a reporter who needs a story, is around,
that's right,
Halloween, and bumps into Edison on the street, and spiritualism is the fad of the day, and so asks Edison about the potential of an apparatus to communicate with the dead, and so Edison replies.
Yep. He probably said, now tell me, do you think you could invent something like that? And then he ran with it. We'll be back in a moment with Dr. Stephen Rourke on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie. Our guest tonight, Dr. Stephen Rourke. His website is linked up at coasttocoastam.com. It is spiricomstudy.com. I'll spell it for you, spiricomstudy.com. Stephen, let's talk a little bit about Spiricom now and George Meek and how that relates to EVPs, ITCs, if you would.
Sure. Yeah, we provide some context, perhaps. Well, first, it's important to establish Spiricom as central to the study of EVP and ITC because of its nearly mythological status. Also, it's recognized as some of the best evidence out there for afterlife communications, survival of personality after death, because the background of the story is essentially in 1980, William O'Neill, who was working with George Meek of MetaScience Foundation, reportedly made contact with a supposedly discarnate being, what they called a deceased NASA scientist named George J. Mueller, using the Mark IV Spiracom device. So when we get into the details of the device, and some of that is important, but it's probably most important at this point to understand that Spiracom itself is attractive to people interested in ITC and EVP for two reasons. One, the claims of Spiracom are imminently testable, because no matter what you think of the documentation, it is a well-documented claim. That is not to make a judgment about the claims, but simply to say that they don't just say they had these communications. There are tapes of these communications. There were audio presentations at National Press Club events where announcements were made about these new possibilities of metaphysics and physics converging through instrumental transcommunication.
Well, now, this device, can you tell us what it looks like, the Spiracom?
You know, I wish I could, but the literature conflicts on what it might look like. We have a description of it where it takes up half a room in this.
It's pretty good size.
John Fuller, yeah, it's pretty good size. In John Fuller's book, The Ghost of 29 Megacycles, you might know John Fuller, by the way, because he also popularized the Betty Barney Hill story. But this device is described as very large, and hey, he looks like he's correct, because the pictures we have of William O'Neill at the Spiracom device operating, it's huge. It's taking up an entire wall. And yet, we also have reports of the Spiracom being like a tabletop size, and even a shelf size unit was given to Sarah Estep to experiment with, and she didn't get similar results at all. But all that being said, I wish I could tell you what it looked like. I can tell you with some degree of certainty what the components were without being too egg-headed.
Okay,
It had these audio oscillators, and there were 13 of them, and that's probably for no mystical reason. It was really just it was an attempt to approximate the tone range of an adult male voice should a discarnate being, you know, require some approximation of a voice box. It had a radio transmitter and a receiver. Now, it transmitted at 29.57 megahertz. And there was also this other variety of equipment. And so you can understand here conceptually what's going on is there is a transmitter in a room, there's a receiver in a room, and in between those two, there is the operator and these oscillating tones that the operator hopes some discarnate being will use as an audio carrier wave to send messages. There was some other equipment involved, like video readouts and things of this like. Even an artificial larynx device was involved in some of their early research. So that's basically the background on it. You know, there were no real schematics, so there's only so much detail anyone can claim to know about the internal components of the Spiracom. There were only these block diagrams.
All right, we're going to get into some of your research in just a second here, Stephen, but I want to play the first couple tracks that you've provided for us. The first one is George Meek introducing Spiracom. Tell me about that before we play it here.
Ah, yes, and quite importantly, he doesn't just introduce Spiracom. This is from a rare find from the MetaScience archive. So, in other words, what folks are about to hear is not the commonly regurgitated Spiracom quote-unquote evidence. This is brand new evidence from a documentary George Meek participated in, where he not only introduces conceptually what the Spiracom device was, but also introduces the discarnate scientist, introduces him as Dr. Mueller. And then after we know more about Dr. Mueller, claiming he's a NASA scientist with folks working under him at the space program, the track immediately following that will then provide actual audio evidence given to us by the MetaScience organization purporting to be two-way communication with the dead. So track one is just what you said.
Let's listen to it.
In 1981, my colleague William O'Neill and I had more than 20 hours of two-way voice communication with the American scientist, Dr. George Jeffries Mueller. When we talked to Dr. Mueller via electronic equipment in 1981, he had died and been buried 14 years earlier. Yet it was Dr. Mueller's astral or etheric body with which we were talking. His superb mind, memory banks, personality, and soul were just as alive as when he had been directing a large staff of scientists in the U.S. space program.
Boy, these old cuts are classic, Stephen, aren't they?
Oh, they really are. It gives you the feel for being back then and how these claims must have appeared to people and how they must have both elicited, I guess, some degree of laughter, maybe even anger from the scientific community and some excitement from the paranormal enthusiasts at the time.
Okay, now track two, which we'll listen to. This is a Spiracom promotional tape, I guess, right?
Well, yes. Now, I want you to imagine this press club event now in 1982. This is the Washington Press Club, so this is legit. And he has a panel of scientific experts with him from his MetaScience Foundation. And part of the press kit, in addition to a transcript of the entirety of a presentation, is also an audio presentation where George Meek, wove together with his narration some of the more interesting EVP ITC audio clips. Now, mind you, this tape was a 90-minute cassette, and since we're not really going to play the whole 90 minutes, this is about 1 minute long. It'll give you a flavor of the entirety of the cassette with a really good example of the William O'Neill Spiracom George Mueller audio.
Okay.
It was our great good luck to come into contact with a scientist among the so-called dead who identified himself as Dr. George Jeffries Mueller. He told us where we could find a copy of his death certificate issued in 1967. He told us his Social Security number, and he told us intimate details of his life and scholastic activities at the University of Wisconsin and Cornell University, his instructorship in physics at Cornell, and his top-level jobs in government and industry. His photograph and biographical data are given in our publication entitled Spiracom.
That's much better right there, William.
Yes, sir, I understood, Doctor.
Very well.
Since one of the first rules of science is that of replication, nothing could be more gratifying than to have Dr. Mueller's conversation confirm that we had at last established meaningful instrumental communication with a person who had shed his physical body.
Now, Stephen, that sounds like someone who had a larynx problem, and they're talking with one of those little voice apparatuses that they hold up to their throat and Adam's apple.
Ah, you are not the first person to say that, but good ear. In fact, there's a Fate magazine article, going back a ways, the first folks to look into the veracity of these claims at the evidential level with the audio was a Dr. David Rivers, speech language expert, a linguist and speech pathologist, who was an expert in these sort of devices, you know, the post-laryngectomy folks who needed these devices. He was on the cutting edge at the time. And when he was asked to take a look, or should say a listen, to these Spiracom audio clips, his conclusion was the same as yours. It sounded a lot like an electrolarynx. Now, only later did we come to learn through my investigation that in the rough draft of the Spiracom manual, on page 30, it mentions, briefly in passing, that MetaScience itself was in possession of an artificial larynx, an electrolarynx device. And so we'll be able to catch up to David Rivers' claims and even hear some new attempts at replicating the Spiracom audio sound through other devices like that popular kind of Bon Jovi Frampton device. These were all technologies that were available at the time. So people are probably getting the idea that this can be proven as a hoax, which brings us to an even more interesting question. If it was a hoax, and folks will have to decide that on their own, if it was a hoax, for what reason? You know, cui bono, who benefited? Mm-hmm. It is an awfully elaborate hoax if it was one. So when we walk through the evidence and people make up their own minds, by the end of the program tonight, I hope to walk them through some of the more interesting models that explain the high strangeness around Spiracom, like the perpetuation of the myth itself and all of these hours and hours of audio evidence by way of these Spiracom tapes. Now, speaking of Spiracom tapes, I assured you earlier that that clip, when folks heard the first clip played, that was something not commonly heard because it's from a rare documentary George Meek participated in, and the second clip was from the promotional cassette that went out. Mm-hmm. Well, we also have some newly discovered Spiracom audio. And keeping in mind what you had just said, how it kind of sounds like the oscillations of an electrolarynx device, keep that in mind as you hear the newly discovered Spiracom audio and note the clarity. It's as if the original Spiracom audio, now I know some could say it lacks fidelity because it's from a cassette, and this newly discovered Spiracom audio is from reels, so it could just be inherently more hi-fi. However, the clarity in the newly discovered Spiracom audio shows a whole lot of inconsistencies at the evidential level. You can almost hear where the operator of the device, William O'Neill, is sometimes, well, he sometimes sounds like he's in approximation of an electrolarynx device and is modulating it with his speech and then immediately switches into the Mueller voice like a schizophrenic or someone with a split personality. And while people listen, see if you ever hear an instance when the two voices speak at the same time.
All right, here we go.
No, I just turned the camera, TV camera on, sir.
What did you say, William?
I said I just turned the TV camera on.
Oh, very well.
You never know, doctor.
Yes, I understand, William. No, right now, very well. Now, let's get on with this. And what I suggest, William, is that we disregard this audio project.
Audio project?
Yes. In your words, Spiracom, and get on with the television aspects.
Oh, I see. Yeah, I see.
How much better it would be not only to be able to speak, but to visualize the subject you were speaking to. You understand, William?
Yeah, I understand. Just a minute, sir. Just a minute.
Now, Stephen, do you know if Meek was by himself when he was doing these?
Well, actually, that was William O'Neill, the operator.
That was O'Neill, okay.
Of the Spiracom device, and you are correct. He was alone while performing these sessions with the supposedly deceased NASA scientist, Dr. George Jeffries Mueller. So you're correct in your immediate suspicion. If he were alone,
yes,
while doing this, it kind of brings to question some of the veracity of the claims. However, there are videotapes of O'Neill performing these sessions. I mean, there are also hours and hours of videotape where, you know, he's at the device and the oscillators are going and the 13 tones are resonating in the room and nothing occurs for hours and hours. But there, it's punctuated by these instances where he's at the device, apparently tuning, fine-tuning through intuition, his self-proclaimed psychic abilities, and the instructions of Dr. Mueller. But wouldn't you know it, his back is always to the camera.
All right, now tell me a little bit, in the moments we have remaining here this hour, about your research. How do you conduct it? What are you looking at?
Well, I took a primary source documentation approach. It was mentioned earlier how if Spiracom is an enduring mystery, it's important to look at it in an interdisciplinary way. First, you must look at it evidentially and try to bring some standards of research instead of just dismissing it offhand or accepting it blindly. Bring some testability to it. So a big part of what science is replication, and of course even to the point of falsification, which isn't to insinuate that you put fake evidence in as real evidence. What I'm saying by falsifying is you attempt to reproduce something with the technology of the day, thereby coming to a conclusion if it could have been faked. And so that's a big part of the research. There was a huge biographical background piece, so who were the players? What was the mental condition of the mental status of the main Spiracom players? Was there a real Dr. Mueller? You know, these are all important questions that needed to come to bear upon the enduring Spiracom mystery.
But with your investigating, and you said the plans are out, that this thing was almost as big as a room. Is there anybody out there now, besides Frank's box, developing any kind of incredible technology to allow us to do what we need to do to communicate with the dead?
Well, this is what they claim to do, and honestly, I don't know how. Because if they're making Spiracom-like devices, they're basing it on a black box kind of technology. And to make matters worse, the fact that there's no technological transparency to the device itself, because all that's out there is block diagrams, which basically show nothing in the way of electronic circuitry. To make matters worse, the MetaScience Foundation itself in 1985, this is years after they had very little success with the Spiracom, eventually they stopped having these sessions.
Stephen, we're going to take this break and we're going to come right back. Let me ask you about that when we come back. Plus, we've got many more Spiracom tapes here that we want to play. Now, wait till you hear some of the new Spiracom audio clips we're going to play later on this hour. Our guest is Dr. Stephen Rourke, and we'll be back with him more and talk to him about his research on Coast to Coast AM. Stephen, what would these individuals who are working with Spiracom, what would they gain to create fraud? I mean, were they making money on this? What were they doing?
Well, therein lies the rational need for just a step-by-step research approach that that this current investigation has run through. First, I mean, the recognition of a mystery, the formulation of models or hypotheses to explain it, gathering new facts, new documentation like you've just heard, even experimentation on our own to attempt to reproduce those sounds that were found on the Spiracom tape, and then continue to form new hypotheses to try to account for the continued high strangeness in the story. So ultimately, I think it comes down to motivation, and this requires multiple models to explain it. I don't, let's say, have a pet theory about it, but I can tell you that there was the potential for a monetary motive, even though the materials were never patented, copyrighted, or trademarked. So it seems a little incongruous to the listener, I understand, when they say, well, wait a second, this stuff was free and was offered up to researchers. How could there possibly have been a monetary motive? That's a really good question, but if you look just past the mythology of Spiracom into some of the primary source documents, you find that the MetaScience Foundation had an operating budget that I can document for at least 2 years. Now, I cannot speak for the rest of the years from primary source documentation, but
okay.
I have a memorandum from the internal files of MetaScience that states they had an operational budget of $250,000 per year, and this is 1980 money. 1980, 1981.
That's huge money. And that was all what, donations?
Well, that's therein lies some of the mystery, the continued mystery of Spiracom, because George, $250,000 doesn't explain. It doesn't come close to explaining the expenditures on a, let's say, a modified sideband radio, which is basically what Spiracom was in the end.
And once you make it, your expenses generally should stop.
And maybe even a profit motive is there, because In Alexander McRae's book, EVP in New Dimensions, McRae was an intimate of George Meek's, and George Meek visited McRae on the Isle of Skye. And McRae recounts his receiving a flyer for a Spiracomb for sale by the MetaScience Research Foundation for $10,000.
Well, we will open up the phone lines later tonight, and maybe someone out there has one of these things. Wouldn't that be interesting,
yeah,
Stephen?
That would be cool. And in fact, I can. I'm going to have to save this for later, but I can even tell folks where the actual Spiracomb device is. This is one of the enduring mysteries involved in the Spiracomb. Is, hey, if it was real in any sense, Rourke, you know, where is the stuff today? Was it absconded? You know, through some covert intelligence operation to hide it from us. And no, I know where it is, but I do believe there are potential psychological operation models that might apply to some of the high strangeness around this, just some of the high strangeness being this money issue we've just raised.
Okay, the players again, George Meek, he was the developer of Spiracomb.
Well, essentially,
right?
Yes, he was the... let's say he was the benefactor to William O'Neill, who developed the Spiracomb. Now, the Spiracomb itself, Mark IV indicates that there must have been Marks 1 through 3, and there were other versions of the Spiracomb device. But essentially, the one that purportedly yielded the greatest success, these 20 hours plus of conversations with a supposedly deceased NASA scientist, those were with the Mark IV device. So in a way, you could say that Meek... also developed Spiracomb in a way. But the Mark IV was almost entirely William O'Neill's creation, a self-proclaimed psychic medium and, you know, offbeat mystic who intuitively would guide himself through the creation of technological devices to communicate with otherworldly realms.
All right. And Mueller was the alleged spirit voice contacted. Was he the only voice they contacted?
No, and this is very interesting. It leads to a question about William O'Neill. William O'Neill communicated through the early Mark IV, like the prototypical Spiracomb. He communicated with a Doc Nick. He communicated with another individual named Frank Engstrom, who was supposedly from... circa 1800s in Virginia. Now, there are some inconsistencies which are glaring when you hear the we won't hear the Engstrom audio tonight because it's so grating and O'Neill's voice is so distant because it's so prototypical in its recording and performance. But it's interesting to note that Fred and Doc were communicated with supposedly before Dr. George Jeffries Mueller, a deceased NASA scientist. And the reason I say it's interesting is because you remember earlier I made what might have seemed like an unfair characterization of William O'Neill as a schizophrenic. Well, it just so happens that my primary source investigations have brought me to documents relating to the mental health status of Bill O'Neill, the developer of the Spiracomb, the man operating the device. O'Neill was a mentally disturbed individual who also had, listen to this, a ventriloquist's skill set.
Oh.
And we know this to be true because he performed a children's show while he lived in Cincinnati, and we know this to be true by his interview with John Fuller, and we know that this actually occurred and was not just some fantasy of his, because I have found a screen capture image of O'Neill dressed in his cowboy uniform with a puppet on his lap, and that image can be found on SpiracomStudy.com, and so can some of these clips from tonight. And that establishes him as having a ventriloquist skill set. But how about his mental health status? Well, it's relayed in Fuller's book, The Ghost of 29 Megacycles, that O'Neill is a manic who sought psychological treatment. I found by way of MetaScience files and an obit that William O'Neill died in Torrance State Medical Facility. It was a mental hospital in Deary, Pennsylvania. He died under care for schizophrenia. And now, compounding this scenario now is findings from studies done in academia about schizophrenics. And these studies of schizophrenics find that it is quite common in schizophrenics that the names Doc and Fred are names schizophrenics commonly use to identify imagined entities they interact with. And I remind the listeners that Doc, Nick, and Fred Engstrom were among the first contacts O'Neill made using that prototypical Spiracom technology.
Okay, now, if I'm hearing you right, you're saying that EVPs could be real. We don't know where they're coming from. Spiracom, your jury's out on that, but it sounds like you don't think it's real.
Ah, yes. I'd like to make one, just with one caveat. Everything you said is correct, except I have come to a conclusion of fraud regarding Spiracom, but maybe not the fraud a lot of folks would think, because I'm willing to entertain the idea that William O'Neill was not a mentally ill person who perpetrated a hoax. He could have been mentally ill, and this could have been a self-deception that was interpreted as real by others. It could even have been the chicken before the egg question. Was O'Neill driven insane by something resulting in the Spiracom sessions, or was he already crazy? And
I
so
wonder,
I'm willing to concede that
okay.
point.
I wonder if he was possessed or something like that, Stephen. You never know.
Well, yeah, I mean, I couldn't go that far, but in some of the Spiracom-related literature, people have kind of hypothesized that as an explanation for his later erratic behavior and detention in a mental health facility. So all this comes back again to that model I proposed earlier. It's a simple scientific model of, you know, finding a mystery, formulating a hypothesis, finding new facts and experimentation, and then seeing if it all checks out. Well, under that simple model, two things must be done then. You must take the background of the players and always go back to the evidence. And the most testable evidence we have here is not the mental health status of Bill O'Neill, because though we have documents relating to it, Bill O'Neill is deceased. What we do still have, though, is those Spiracom tapes. Now, it sounded to both of us like it might have been an electrolarynx, but the problem is, how does one perform, even if you are a ventriloquist, how does one pull off this back and forth? Because if people have ever seen electrolarynx be used, it's when used properly, it's put up against the throat. This would appear to be a slightly different sound quality and would allow for a lot of movement in William O'Neill, which essentially we don't see when he's operating the device in the video. So enter Dr. David Rivers, who replicates the Spiracom effect, using an electrolarynx device incorrectly. He uses the device in front of his lips so that the oral cavity and of William O'Neill could have been modulating the sound. In other words, mouthing the sound rather than throwing your voice, still technically a ventriloquist-type skill set being employed, but using the device in an incorrect way. And, boy, is Rivers' audio compelling. It sounds, I mean, the listeners have to make their minds up themselves, but it sounds a lot like the Spiracom device.
Let's listen to it.
Now, I'm going to read a brief passage for you with the electrolarynx held in front of my lips.
Now, what's interesting and needs to be brought into this piece of evidence right here is the fact that in the Spiracom manual, Meek himself stated, people will claim that this is ventriloquism. So this was either a subtle knowing that he came out and stated as to take this this confirming piece of evidence away from debunkers, a kind of preservation of beliefs that Meek might have taken. We know Meek's knew all about O'Neill's ventriloquism mastery. He knew all about that because O'Neill had told him about this many times in his – he recounts it in his own books, in fact, George Meek. Also, what needs to be brought to bear upon this is a reminder that while you may Google the Spiracom manual, the technical manual, not in every manual out there, but in the manual I have, the first printing on page 30, it states that the MetaScience organization was in possession of an electrolarynx device.
Uh-huh.
Now, how are we to say, though, that O'Neill possessed the device? Well, there's two ways to do that. One is to either say David Rivers lays out such a compelling comparison as to say, hey, this has got to be it, it's case closed. You could also go to the modern day, the current president of MetaScience. He was bequeathed the mantle by George Meek himself, and he's the head of MetaScience. His name is Thomas Pratt. And Thomas Pratt has relayed to me that part of the manifest, part of the actual components and electronic equipment he has in a facility housing all the old Spiracom devices is an electrolarynx. But someone could still argue, listening to that, that the quality is not quite exact. So is there anything else, is there any other technology of the day that might approximate that Spiracom sound that might have been, let's say, a little less cost prohibitive? I mean, after all, it could be that O'Neill did not possess the electrolarynx device that George Meek conceded to having in his possession as early as 1979 as part of the MetaScience equipment. So a much cheaper device that could almost replicate the same Spiracom sound is found in an old talk box. People know it from the Peter Frampton songs and things like this. It's often called a Frampton device. So in 2006, I contracted a producer to create a Spiracom effect. This was an open-ended challenge, and again, this is science, is testing the falsifiability of evidence. I simply sent Tim Loud some...
And he was a producer, right?
Yes, a producer with a variety of vintage equipment, okay? I sent him just a few Spiracom clips and said, if you were in 1980, how would you recreate this sound? So he had no context for this beyond what he was hearing. And, in fact, he conceded that he thought it might have been ham radio except for the Frampton device-like sound effect. And so we have now a way to triangulate, a way to explain through multiple technologies of the day, and this current one being a little bit cheaper. You could have gotten a talk box in 1980 for about $100 from a music store. So the track you're about to play is actually a very contemporary confirmation of David Rivers' findings, except Dr. Rivers was using an electrolarynx.
Okay, we'll hear this one now.
That's much better right there, William. Now, William, did you understand? William. Very well. I want to give you a help from 1 to 10. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. One moment, William.
We're going to play some other tracks when we come back from the break. Now, you know what? These are weird, Stephen, aren't they?
Oh, they have a strange quality, which I think is what made them compelling to paranormal enthusiasts. Even to this day, as we said, it kind of spawned the ITC EVP contemporary field of research.
You know what? I was going to say I'm dying to find out some more conclusions about your EVP, but I don't want to end up on any of your voice tracks.
Oh no, don't invite any of that.
No, not at all.
You know what would be great though, George, is when we come back, people can hear a compare contrast, a side by side clip after clip analysis of the Spiracom O'Neill Mueller interaction, the David Rivers Dr. Rivers audio larynx, and the Tim Loud Frampton device, a side-by-side of them saying the same things, and they can judge if they're not so close as to give really a means by which these could have been falsified. So we might want to consider them as a hoax.
Why do the EVP sounds always seem so angry? You don't really get a lot of friendly ones. I mean, there's always some hostility going on.
It does seem that they're full of character, and this could, again, be apophenia or auditory pareidolia. It could be our interpretation of these things, because our context for finding EVPs, right, is that these are, you know, the voices of dead people is the fairly obvious hypothesis for most weekend ghost hunters. So the expectation to be fulfilled is that it might be some, you know, malevolent spirit.
Okay, back with more of your research, Stephen Rourke, and more of these incredible tracks when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. Let's listen to some of the rest of these tracks, Stephen, while we have time remaining this half hour. And then I want to get your impressions on the Spiracom and then dive into EVPs, and then we'll take phone calls next hour, okay?
Well, sounds good. As long as we can get to some of those more interesting
psychological
operations models.
Absolutely. Okay, now let's talk about this next one that you talked about, which was the contrast comparison.
Yeah, this is perfect for the audience because we can't really expect people to remember, let's say, an hour ago what the Spiracom sounded like. So this is just a less than half a minute. It's a side-by-side comparison, a stringer, if you will, of the following three clips. It is the O'Neill Mueller Spiracom, then the Dr. Rivers replication using an electrolarynx device, then the Tim Loud device, the Frampton device as reproduced by Tim Loud. And all the levels were equalized by Brian Jones, and this is a really tight presentation, so I think the audience will be able to draw a conclusion from this. I'm not telling them what to think, but this sure will give them something to think about.
All right, here we are. They're all pretty close.
Yeah, they are. If it's not, in other words, if it's not one, the electrolarynx, it could have been the other less expensive device of its day, the Frampton device, available at guitar stores at the time. And O'Neill, I contend, was such a handy guy. You could even make one. All you need is like a resonance chamber with a tube that you could kind of put your lips in approximation of the tube and through your oral cavity modulate the sound. It might also explain the guy who put this stringer together, Brian Jones, made an interesting observation. He noticed that this discarnate voice, the dead Dr. Mueller, doesn't really call Bill O'Neill Bill O'Neill, because Bill O'Neill would be too difficult to say with the punctuated B of Bill. Rather, it's always William, and if people notice that it's easier to say William if they would attempt to mouth it right now, there might be a good reason why the entirety of the Spiracom tapes lend themselves in this way. The conversations lend themselves to easily mouthed rather than pronounced conversation on the part of Dr. Mueller.
All right, we're going to jump ahead to track 8, Stephen.
Yeah.
And now this one is a new Spiracom audio clip. Tell us about this.
Yeah, you're correct. This is an example of how the higher fidelity, newly discovered Spiracom audio reveals so much more about what was going on in that lab with William O'Neill. You'll be able to hear, because of its high fidelity, you'll be able to hear where William O'Neill's voice and Mueller's voice complete each other's sentences, and instead of it being drowned out by the background noise, the clarity of this recording allows you to hear clearly what sounded like a mistake by a ventriloquist, not some psychic discarnate voice completing the sentence of a live man.
Here we go.
Well, I'll tell you what, sir. Why don't I shut the system down, switch over to this other RF generator, and see if it's stable now, sir.
He's talking to Mueller as if he's still alive.
Well, he sure is. And this, of course, is part of the Spiracom mythos, is that there's like a lab in a post-fourth dimensional existence, and these technicians are giving real-time help to create equipment to communicate with them. This is all part of the mythology around Spiracom that contributes to the modern day ITC mythology. Folks like Mark Macy, in fact, use that exact language of a time stream and technicians and imagining this other realm where they give direction to experimenters and operators of devices.
Track 9, another new Spiracom audio clip. O'Neill and Mueller are talking again. Just a different phrase, right?
Yeah. Well, yes, but this is more interesting because you'll actually hear a little crosstalk when the phrase old equipment is stated. Listen closely. It sounds as if O'Neill must be in proximity of the tube or the electrolarynx device, because when he says old, those two O's are punctuated not only by his voice, but also by the Mueller voice, as if it might just be one person in the room in proximity of a device when he wants to imitate a Mueller voice.
Okay.
Yes, sir. Well, as I mentioned, sir, I'm going to shut this equipment down, change from this old equipment, as we call it, to this RF generator. Old equipment.
You know, to me, Stephen, listening to O'Neill, it sounds like an old guy who may or may not be whacked out, who is having fun doing what he's doing, and it sounds like he believes what he's doing.
That's part of, at one level, what made it convincing. For so many paranormal enthusiasts, is that that compelling part of it? It's clearly not, you know, he's not chuckling along here. This is obviously what he considers to be
a serious
endeavor. Although I must state, it's been recounted in the literature that the nature of the conversations is so trite that's one problem almost everyone has with it. Like if you had the opportunity to speak with someone that you truly believe to be dead. You wouldn't be having these ad nauseum conversations about tuning the dials and what diode to change.
I'd want to talk to my father's father, my grandfather, whom I never met. He died before I was born.
See, these are what you're saying. These are better rationales, and those would be better points, talking points in a conversation with a real dead person. But you can hear that. It's kind of trite. It's mostly like ham radio talk. People are tuning dials, and some of the conversations not listed here tonight, but available on SpiracomStudy.com and elsewhere. They're about like cabbage and what their favorite vegetables are and why you shouldn't smoke cigarettes. It's just so trite.
Art Bell's a ham, and I'll really freak if I hear his voice pop up on one of these things.
Oh, boy.
We're going to run the next three relatively close together, William. Give us just an overall synopsis of them.
I think it might be best, and you let me know, because you've got the schedule in front of you. But those phone calls from the dead, You remember I mentioned a Radova character much earlier.
Right.
Constantine Radova, who was featured in this book that as a kid I thought was fiction. It turns out there really was this Latvian psychologist who did this groundbreaking work called Breakthrough and popularized EVP in Europe, which eventually came to America as a phenomenon, a recognized phenomenon. This Radova figure is supposedly one of these time stream technicians, you see. And he actually had the opportunity to make a phone call from the dead. This is the alleged phone call from the dead. So Radova calls Meek, Radova calls others and leaves messages to triangulate his existence as proof. And it's very interesting that the nature of the phone calls is, again, not particularly insightful. And if I might say, the calls we can play actually paint a picture of a power grab within the paranormal community rather than a legitimate concern from some deceased entity. So we could actually state, before we play those, the context by way of seeing more about who Meek and O'Neill were, who could have influenced these calls to be made, because there's actually a strange NASA mind control connection to all of this, and it is not straining. It can be documented. It's not straining to bring those pieces in. It's your call. We could go with them now and then fill in some of the blanks afterwards.
Okay, let's play the first one here.
Good morning, this is George Meek.
This is Constantine Rodenberg. George, my friend, at last we succeeded in contacting you. Jeanette is beside me, and she wants to give you all her love. This is Constantine Rodenberg. This is the first contact you get from us.
Now, on any of these, Stephen, on any of them, does the voice that comes through talk about being dead?
No, that's a really good point, actually. It doesn't state the case. However, the fact that this voice is claiming to be that of Dr. Constantine Radova, who is known to have been dead for, you know, decades at that point, it's implicit, it's implied that would have been a phone call from the dead to George Meek in his last years of living. And what's almost cruel about that, unless, of course, you do believe it's a phone call from the dead, what's cruel about it is it talks about Meek's deceased wife being there and yet doesn't put her on the phone.
Yeah.
And it even says, we've contacted Mark and we must go now. And then the next track played will actually be a phone call from Constantine Radova explaining who they prefer to contact.
Okay, let's hear this one.
This is Constantine Radova speaking. We just tried to contact George Meek. We succeeded, but he didn't get what he wanted to do. Tell him, click Mark until you will have strengthened the bridge to our time stream. This is Constantine Radova speaking.
You can hear the entire point of that call after the George Meek call was essentially to paint a picture of, we called George Meek, time stream, Constantine Radova has called George Meek, and we had to go because the connection wasn't strong enough. However, we call you, colleague Mark Macy, because we prefer to contact you. You know, that's a... That's the message of it. It's as if there's a paranormal power grab within these organizations by way of potentially hoaxed phone calls from the dead. Which brings us to an important kind of aspect of this is maybe some of this was inside job type psychological operations, a conspiracy from within. The connection from Spiracom back then to the contemporary Spiracom story is best outlined in a book by Dr. Patricia Kubis and Mark Macy. It's called Conversations Beyond the Light, in which the Spiracom story is prominently
heavily featured in that.
Featured, yes. Yeah. And so in this book, it states, by the way, this is written again by Dr. Patricia Kubis and Mark Macy. And Kubis in this book recounts her time at Orange Coast College. Okay, now follow this chain of events. It's very interesting, this connection. Orange Coast College is the last place of employ for the Dr. Mueller on the Spiracom tapes when he was alive.
Interesting.
Uh-huh. So, and now, records reveal, when you go back to the faculty log books, you can open up a faculty log book and find, and this is posted on spearcomstudy.com, reproducing the researcher Guy Jackson, who originally discovered this overlap of employment, that Dr. Kubis, who co-authored the book with Mark Macy, featuring the Spiracom story, worked concurrently with the Dr. Mueller purported to be on the Spiracom tapes. And check this out. Mark and she claimed to never have known that point till it was brought up to them within the past year. Now, I find that very hard to believe. And
how could they miss that?
It seems impossible. Now, I went through the trouble of interviewing via telephone, taped for posting, so she knew all about it. It was a legit telephone interview. She does claim to never have known him. She is quite aged, so I'm going to trust her recollection. But when folks like Mark Macy say that's not an important point, it's details. You know, let's stick to the mythology because it confirms our belief system. I think that's where we get into some of the difficult areas in this, as far as what responsibility do people have to look at the Spiracom story and the EVP-ITC movement it's given birth to. Do we have a responsibility to look at this critically, even if it agrees with a given belief system? I say we do, because there's been folks out there using devices just like old spirit mediums. I'm not saying, you know, they're all bad and fake, but there were plenty, and there are still plenty today, who are bilking paranormal enthusiasts and sometimes giving them false hope with devices that might show blurry pictures of supposedly their loved ones. It's just toying with people.
Yeah. Well, I think we have one more last clip here, Dan.
Oh, yes. Go ahead.
Do you have any messages that I can pass along to George Meek?
You know, I wanted to contact them all, but we here decided to contact you because you are the main experimentator and you are the manager, to say so. You are the person we want to address to. So we prefer to contact you because this is the bridge that has been strengthened.
Yeah.
Here's the prefer to contact you claim. It appears to be a paranormal power grab within this ITC community. And I know with the short time provided, there may not be much time to go into all the implications there, but I think it's obvious that if those are hoaxed phone calls from the dead, which would be my perspective, then someone must have been hoaxing them for some psychological operation purposes.
Such as?
Well, again, such as that power grab. See, Mark Macy claims to be the modern-day head of Metascience, claims to have bought the rights to Metascience. However, the real president of Metascience, who possesses all the files, all the technology of the Spiracom, is Thomas Pratt. And Thomas Pratt has got documentation, letters, pictures of he and Meek proving that he is, in fact, the legitimate head of Metascience. And yet, by way of these hoaxed phone calls from the dead, there appears to be a power grab to say, you know,
you're Meek, in charge, Mark.
Meek, step aside. Yeah. Macy's in charge.
Interesting. My, oh my, oh my.
Uh-huh.
All your research got you to this conclusion, and I think you've got it right on. Is medicine still in existence?
It is, and it's a labor of love for Thomas Pratt because it's not a money-making organization. In fact, he pays fees for storage for all the Spiritcom and MetaScience materials. It's not a defunct organization, but it is not as active as it used to be in actual experimentation. Although Thomas Pratt is still a very well-read guy and stays on top of all that, and I've enjoyed greatly my informative conversations with him.
Great work. We're going to be back with you, Stephen. We're going to take phone calls with you next, plus we'll continue the dialogue because I want to, now that you gave us some possibilities of EVPs, I want to dive into that when we come back. With Dr. Stephen Rourke, we're going to take your phone calls. We're going to continue this dialogue as well. When we come back, I want to get Stephen's take on Frank's box. As you know, we had a couple devices in the studio some time ago with Rosemary Ellen Guiley. They did not work at that time, but Rosemary swears by it, and she's a very credible person. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie, and we've got you, Stephen. Stephen?
Yes, hello there.
There you go. Now, tell me a little bit about Frank's box. What do you know?
Well, I know that it's the Frank's box ethos is driven by the same Edison article, the Scientific American article about Edison's attempts to communicate with the dead. The same article that drove George Meek in his belief that instrumental transcommunication could be a reality, that same article is used as a guiding document for modern-day EVP-ITC experimenters. Now, I would not so much question the technology as some of the folks that use it. I would agree with you. I much more believe the honest experimentation of someone like a Rosemary Ellen Guiley, as opposed to someone like, if I might disagree, he's a public figure, Chris Moon. Chris Moon has taken a Frank's box device, renamed it a telephone to the dead, claims that Edison speaks to him and gives him all sorts of protocol for dismissing certain researchers and including others. Sounds kind of familiar, almost like that power struggle we heard earlier with fake phone calls from the dead. And that someone like Chris Moon, when his Frank's box is not just, you know, a telephone to the dead, it's the telephone to the dead. And I know for a fact Chris Moon is charging for Frank's box sessions. So again, I mean, is the misinterpretation of that article leading to yet another cult of techno mediumship? I'd say the answer is yes.
All right. Now, EVPs, on the other hand, that's different, isn't it?
In my mind, it is, George. And that's an important distinction because EVP, again, we'll recapitulate. These are perceived voices of unknown origin recorded on such electronic media as tape recorders, digital recorders, video recorders, other devices. And often the voices are, let's say, not heard at the time of the recording, only upon playback. And EVPs are typically, as you said, known for having certain characteristics that are a little disturbing to listeners sometimes, but they're also known for being faint and rapid, often spoken in grammatically unusual or very simplified language. And the difficulty with EVP and something like Frank's box, in fact, is that it appears to be a transient phenomenon, which does not lend itself very well to scientific replication and repeatability. And that was my argument earlier for bringing in something like the notion of going beyond the standard model of things. You know, we used to be able to do this. There used to be a kind of overlap between the metaphysical community and the physical and the physicists. I'm sure you've heard of shadow matter.
Sure.
Like that, for example, is a commonly held view that it's evidence of a parallel universe. And this parallel universe concept, it amazes most people to learn that that was established by the metaphysical community. In fact, it was Psychical Society members who went on to win Nobel Prizes, and we've all heard of the inventor of the cathode ray tube, Crookes. And so we have all this. We have these mysteries in the universe, and we have these mysteries right here at home in the form of this transient phenomenon that I contend require going beyond the standard model. Now, when it comes to something like this dark matter, scientists are very willing because it's out there. They're very willing to consider, hey, our galaxy would have blown apart billions of years ago because, let's say, the spin is too fast. But what holds our own Milky Way galaxy together is this sphere of dark matter which surrounds it. It weighs 10 times more than our galaxy. We find hints at existence of this by way of Hubble mapping, and that gets all the attention of going beyond the standard model. But something like EVP, which is so clearly a documented phenomenon, whether it be a psychological phenomenon, some sort of sociological phenomenon, maybe it's just a phenomenon of poor production and quality control in recording devices. I don't know, but there is a phenomenon, and I think that it requires an interdisciplinary approach.
Is that going to be your next study? I mean, you concentrated on Spiracom, and we basically know your thoughts and results. What about EVPs? Why don't you do a very thorough examination on those? I think you do a thorough job, Stephen.
You know, and I'm heading that direction, George, and it's beginning with a pretty logical approach of first determining collectively what people consider EVP to be, so get a gold standard as far as the definition goes, then justify why anyone should bother with EVP, and there's good justification for that, by the way, because EVP, as we know, is not generally subject to three conditions that are mistaken as paranormal. People write off lots of things to sleep paralysis, as you know. They write off lots of experiences to hypnagogic hallucination. And people who experience haunting-type events, they oftentimes rationalize that as a sensed presence. Well, clearly, some audio sound on a tape perceived as a voice is objectifiable, testable evidence. It is not sleep paralysis, hallucination, or sense presence. So there's good reason to bother with EVP. And there's this other fascinating aspect, George. Looking back to that historic piece I mentioned about the metaphysical and the physical and how a paranormal phenomenon can graduate to real science. The only way to do that is through this process I'm saying. You know, a paranormal phenomenon simply describes unknown forces which at first appeared to be paranormal and then later, became verified scientifically. Because the peri means in the vicinity of, whereas para is quite the opposite. It means above, beyond, and unexplainable. Well, people have, you know all about examples of paranormal phenomena, and we don't think them strange. And maybe someday we'll think the same about EVP. Here's an example, a modern example of a paranormal phenomenon, EMF. You know, at one time, EMF was debatable from a scientific perspective, but was later proven to be real. And in fact, it's currently accepted by the scientific community. And so the idea is, and here's some of the new thinking I'm bringing to the field, George, maybe what we're dealing with in EVPs is a measurability problem. Because EMFs, until they were detectable, were not justifiable as an actual phenomenon. So maybe we need, in fact, more serious approaches to ITC, Spiracom-like devices, but that means we need to be highly critical of those who claim to have made them. Otherwise, they'll be deconstructed and set everything back instead of forward.
Interesting. Let's take some calls here and continue our dialogue, Stephen. Let's go to Indianapolis, east of the Rockies. Mark, go ahead. You're on with us.
Hi, how you doing this evening?
Great.
That's a pretty interesting program. I'm getting a kick out of it tonight. I'm typically a skeptic when it comes to the whole spooks in the ether thing. And listening, I noticed something on the tapes that nobody really pointed out or seemed to notice. It seems like the guy leaving the messages is taking big, giant breaths in between just about everything he says. Now, if he were really a spook, he wouldn't have any lungs. Or the need to breathe if you saw them through an electronic device.
Interesting.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you wouldn't have a voice box either.
Right. I kind of got a kick out of that.
That's good.
But, that is good. The whole spook thing has always given me kind of a kick because, once again, if they're dead, you wouldn't see them like they were when they were alive. They wouldn't have a body. They certainly wouldn't be wearing clothes.
Oh, you know what's wild? I've got to piggyback on this call because an interesting part of ITC, you know, instrumental transcommunication, mm-hmm. an interesting part of that is like trying to receive images from these ethereal realms. The caller and I are both having trouble with justifying. And the images, wouldn't you know it, they're often images that are essentially copies of stock photographs of people on file. For example, this George Mueller from the Spearcom tape
supposedly
came through in an ITC message, and Mark Macy has this image on his website. Well, if you look at the image of Dr. Mueller that he claims came by way of a like a Vidicom, it's essentially his Cornell University faculty photo that he just kind of turned in the negative and tinted it blue. So the idea of it wouldn't be so much like this. In fact, if these were actual phone calls from the dead, they would be so bizarre that we probably couldn't understand them. They wouldn't be like these breathy calls where these voice boxes are resonating. And, of course, they cut off so early as to give you no information as to be like an almost a trickster phenomenon like George Knapp so aptly continues to document.
So what if, back to EVPs for a moment, mm-hmm. that they were recordings of other dimensions. Somehow they're picking up these transmissions or these sounds.
Ah.
That, to me, is almost as fascinating, if not more, than life after death.
Well, and now here you bring in contemporary physics, because let's say that thought itself, right, this consciousness debate we're having, it's the mind-body problem we've had for years in philosophy and the sciences. What if thought itself is a stable structure that exists in higher dimensional space-time fabric? And I only say higher dimensional space-time fabric because this 11-dimensional string theory, for example, is all the rage. Well, what we see and feel is four dimensions, three of space and one of time. And the theoretical physicist currently suggesting that there could be 10 dimensions of space and one of time, making an 11-dimensional universe that we might be able to perceive through extended instrumentation. See, we're back to that measurability problem there. Perhaps through instrumentation that can perceive these other dimensions, we might come to elicit a reality for the origins of these voices. So I contend with you, this is pretty interesting, and an interesting aspect of higher dimensional reality could be that a being residing there would be able to interact with us or predict events of our four-dimensional world, since they would have a quote-unquote better view, let's say.
Let's go to Los Angeles. Hello, Charles, take it away.
Yes, sir. Just wanted to make, before I said what I called for, the one that just fellow that just called in before me, I wanted to correct something. They do wear clothes on the other side. If they've made their ascension, they look very, very beautiful or handsome. But the elderly gentleman, whether he's telling the truth about what happened or not, I just wanted to let you know, you said he apparently passed away in a mental institution. Well, 1948, our government arrested Dr. Bronner. He was Albert Einstein's nephew. And in those days, they signed one doctor could sign a short Doyle method, and boom, they could send you up to Alaska in a few days' time. And you're supposed to get a trial within 3 days. He was there for 2 weeks and nothing, and they wouldn't let him use the bathroom or anything. And so they wrote all kinds of garbage on his report. Anyway, the night before, he finally found someone that would make arrangements, you know, for a hearing for him. And the night before, they came in and gave him a shot that would make you incoherent so you couldn't speak.
Uh-huh.
This was in 1948.
Why were they after him?
He, among other things, he kept the fluoride out of our water for years.
Well, he should be around today, Charles.
Yeah. So does the caller believe that or have any evidence that this is something that happened with O'Neill? I don't get the connection.
No, no, I'm not at all. I'm just saying that that type of thing used to be used to happen quite frequently. So that could be a possibility why he was there. I don't know.
Just to be real clear, I'll give you some of the background that wasn't brought up earlier. O'Neill died in palliative mental care in 1991, and so this is hardly 1948, and he was put there by his family out of concern for his own well-being. So it's hardly the case you're talking about of abduction and drugging and all this.
Stephen, if Metascience is still around in some capacity through this Pratt fellow,
mm-hmm.
does he have a machine or a device?
He has the Spiricom.
He's got the one.
He's got the Spiricom, and he's brought it to back to operational levels. I believe it only took a few vacuum tube replacements, and I am quoting when I say it is one of his objectives to someday give Dr. Mueller his voice back. However, at the same time, and not to paint him as a conflicted character, just to paint him as one who is of a scientific mind himself, he shares some of the concerns about Spiricom while also saying he would like to be open-minded enough to attempt to give Dr. Mueller his voice back.
Do you trust him?
Yes, I mean I trust him in which way? You mean we're friendly via telephone. I trust his mental health status, if that's what you're asking. He is a well-read individual, and he's always willing to consider, and here's why I trust his habit of mind when it comes to considering these things. He's always willing to consider all potential explanations. So he's willing to consider that, hey, none of this was real, and maybe this was some kind of inside job, some kind of psychological operation by an insider, or he's willing to go past where I stand and consider even that this was a discarnate NASA scientist.
Let's go to Rochester, New York, and we've got you, Greg. Go ahead, Greg.
How you doing? I just got a quick question. The gentleman before you also made a comment about the breaths, and that was my first question.
Yeah.
But the next one is, do these people ever describe what the other side looks like, and do they compare in descriptions?
Yeah, I know what you mean. Is there an internal consistency to the descriptions of these otherworldly realms?
Exactly.
Yeah, I have looked at that, and that's kind of only connected to this research by way of one Mark Macy, who has this entire meticulously constructed fantasy about a Marduk with a different physics, and these Mardukian beings share a description of the heavenly realms of this Marduk. Honestly, I have to say that there is no given internal intrinsic consistency, and I think a lot of the evidence is just plain hokey. That's my opinion. People can look into it, and they can believe what they'd like, but I think some of what is claimed about the beyond by the likes of the current time stream adherents, Mark Macy et al., I think it's certifiable.
How will you set up a study for EVPs when you start to do that?
So first you must eliminate the mundane explanations and then go to the arcane explanations. So I would essentially eliminate things like potential cross-modulation, maybe do a sub-study, a literature review, and a study itself on apophenia. Apophenia, by the way, I know I mentioned it about an hour ago, I should remind folks, is the spontaneous perception of connections and meaningfulness of unrelated phenomenon. So some sound on a tape, your brain conceivably could make sense of it to the point where you say, in context, I believe that to be the voice of my grandmother, let's say.
Even though it's not.
Right. This would be the thinking behind apophenia.
Stephen, let's take final calls when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. Back to EVPs for a second, if we can, Stephen. If we rule out fraud in many of these cases where people are honestly out there trying to get sounds, then we have one heck of a phenomenon, don't we?
Oh, we do. Then you've got to come to the essential questions of how, not necessarily why. I think folks get hung up on the why. You can ask, you know, where do these voices come from? Do they come from our own subconsciousness? Are they spiritual in nature? Do they transmit from other dimensions of reality by some means, the same way physicists currently contend gravity, the inexplicable weakness of gravity, might be explained by way of it stretching across so many extra dimensions. You know, are they the voices of the dead? I'd say some of those questions are not within my purview. I don't approach this as a spiritist, but to answer your question, you know, you'd have to eliminate the fraud, as you said, through a specific way. And that's why I hope to influence, if I have any influence at all, hope to influence paranormal enthusiasts. You can't really call them researchers unless their behavior comports with the scientific method. I've been proposing since 2005 best evidence standards, which people can visit and see at spiritcomstudy.com. And I'm not selling anything. There is not a single PayPal button on the entire site. And the only thing I might be peddling is a future book deal, which would be more about EVP than Spiritcom. And perhaps these best evidence standards, if people would choose to comply with them, I would, in fact, facilitate an experiment.
Now, that sounds good. Back to the calls we go. We'll go to David in California, first-time caller. Go ahead, David.
Hey, George, how you doing?
Good, thank you.
All right. Hey, I just wanted to give you a little anecdote about this, these prank boxes and stuff. That
sure.
I was looking it up on YouTube, you know, just interested in hearing the EVPs, whatever. And I saw the little thumbnail of a thing, how to build a Frank's box, right? And I go, I have that radio. It's a little Radio Shack radio. So I'm thinking, oh, I'll make one of these. And I watched it, and I put a thing together. And so I hooked it up to my you know, hooked it all up and recorded it real quick and just, you know, threw out like, hey, does anybody here want to talk? But I felt stupid saying it, you know, just skeptically asked it and recorded some static and then played it on my computer on a, like a wave program or whatever and played it a little slower and tried to get rid of some static. And I hear, save me, like real, real faint in the background. And I played it to my individual roommates, you know, and they said, you know, oh, yeah. I hear that too, kind of, but what the hell are you doing? You know, this and that. And so, my friend that I was living with, he actually bought the house off of an old widowed lady, and that's all I knew. So I just blew it off. I erased the recording and stuff, and I was telling my neighbor about it, and he goes, "Oh, you know that the old man died in that house, and they also had a daughter back in the 80s or something that killed herself in there. She committed suicide in the house." And then now I'm convinced again.
Yeah. If I could just comment on that, it seems
sure.
That part of that could be exactly what we were discussing before about the spontaneous perception of meaningfulness in random stimuli. If you heard crackles that approximated vocal utterances of save me, and your expectation being that there might be some paranormal connection by way of this device, and there you've gone and invested in doing it, you at some level would desire results. All of that is problematic to the experimental process. Plus all the possibilities, not for fraud, I'm not pointing a finger at anybody, what I'm saying is the possibilities for results being accidentally tampered with is really problematic when you start ripping MP3 conversion, changing these EVPs by accidentally adding audio artifacts from filtering, for example, is a common problem.
Okay, let's go to Dallas, Texas. Jason, take it away. Hey, Jason.
Hi, I've listened to the entire tape at length. And there's times when Dr. Mueller's voice is coming in, but when Bill's not even in the room, you hear him come running up the stairs going, oh, doctor, sorry, I wasn't here. And another thing, you talk about him being committed. Okay, if you went to your family saying, hey, I'm talking to dead people through this box, they'd commit you too, you know? I mean, people weren't ready to hear what this thing was talking about. And you haven't once listed the MetaScience website, which goes in link about what people should know about this. Can I give it out real quick?
Well, here's the problem, sir. There is no MetaScience website because Thomas Pratt is not involved at the website level. The website you're about to give is for Mark Macy, who co-opted fraudulently through fraud and the inducement. He co-opted the presidency of MetaScience. You're about to give the World ITC website. Good. Let folks go look at it. But they should look at it knowing that that man, Mark Macy, is not the legitimate president of MetaScience. That is a fact.
Stephen, we do not give out websites unless we check them out first, so it's not going to be given out.
Oh, even better.
We don't do that. But that could have been one of Mr. Macy's friends.
Probably was.
You never know.
No,
but
you don't.
Everybody's entitled to an opinion.
Well, they are, and part of that is, you know, we have to come to a point where we are willing to update conclusions based on new evidence. And it sounds like he's calling up with the old retreads. And I assure you that in 1980, there would have been a technological means by which he could have pre-recorded the voice of Mueller, left it playing, ran into the room to make it convincing. It really is not very compelling to say he ran up to the device while a Mueller voice was coming out.
How many humans, Stephen, humans, physical humans, were involved in Spiracom at the time of its inception?
From beginning to end all the way up to the very last Mark VI device.
And give us a time period at the same time.
Yeah, I would say the experiments had to end around 1985 because I have an internal memorandum which states plainly all experimentation with these devices has ceased because they were no longer, you know, effective. But it was about 50 players from about the 60s all the way up to that final Spiracom event in the way of those sessions we've heard some of tonight.
Wow, that's a lot. Okay, and then in the beginning, the original players, how many did we have?
Oh, I was saying all told, it would be about 50 from beginning to end. And some of those players, by the way, would be pretty nefarious characters, which brings us to the more interesting psychological operations angle to all this. You're familiar with Jacques Vallée.
He gives a really
interesting take on the UFO phenomenon. And he, for example, contends that UFO research communities are useful laboratories in which to observe the effects of propaganda and disinformation, because they're sealed off and they have a particular belief systems which is highly predictable for someone who would like to manipulate them. Well, the same could be said about the spiritualist and particularly the EVP-ITC movement in the form of these hardcore ITC researchers. It could be that there was a psychological operation by way of one Andreja Puharich. If you know of Puharich, I contend that he might be responsible for a social spiritualist kind of psyops, just as the UFO community is heavily influenced by disinformation, dissemination by well-known authors and lecturers that end up being members of intelligence organizations. So, too, the belief structure of untold thousands has been influenced by this Andreja Puharich. He created this this nine cult, which we could get more into if callers are interested, I guess. But suffice it to say, my best explanation for all the high strangeness surrounding Spiracom is laid at the feet of Andreja Puharich. I call it the mind controller psychological operation model, where he has been everywhere and touched everyone involved with this story. Puharich visited Konstantin Raudova, the man who popularized EVP. Puharich can be found developing mind control devices that are essentially electronic telepathy, voice-to-skull communications. He can be found psychologically manipulating people in seances where they're supposedly in touch with these nine ancient gods of Egypt. Puharich can be found involved in MK Ultra and having close ties to Ira Einhorn, the unicorn killer. He can be found having close ties to a what was called in Ossing, New York, the Turkey Farm, a CIA nickname for what was essentially a gifted, talented children's camp in which he was performing mental measurements, psychometrics, and remote viewing type experiments with them.
Jeez.
This is a strange, nefarious dude, and he was an intimate of George Meek and John Fuller, by the way.
And this guy was everywhere.
He was everywhere, George, and he touched everyone involved, but he's a behind-the-scenes player.
And it sounds like a manipulator.
Clearly. That's my take on him. Now, I know some people have a take on Puharich, which is quite different, but my evidence tends to belie their take. I mean, we have Puharich having a post-war appearance of this group called the Nine, and we wouldn't even talk about the Nine if it had not been for the participation of some of America's most notable families. And some people like, now check this out, we've got chemical and biological researcher, Dr. Lawrence Layton, the father of the only convicted Jonestown murderer, and someone involved in MKUltra, the mind control program. And the message of the nine is so similar to the supposed message of these spirits from beyond. There's an incredible amount of overlaps.
Let's go to Ray, driving around in Missouri. Hey, Raymond, go ahead.
Hi, George.
Hello.
Got a little bit of an observation about something your guest mentioned earlier, the problem of the transient nature of these EVP phenomena.
Okay.
If you take the theory of the multiple universes being, you know, multiple infinite bubbles of different universes.
Mm-hmm.
Well, just like you would have, you had two astronauts in space. You've got vacuum between them. But if they got close enough to where they could put their helmets together, you could have an inductive communication between. And if, say, these different bubble universes brush up against each other, couldn't you be getting an inductive communication from another bubble universe? And it just like the two helmets connecting, it would be muffled, it would be indistinct, possibly hard to understand, which is a lot of the basic phenomenon itself.
Theoretically possible, yeah. Of course, that would require, I mean, to truly prove any of that at, like, the theorem level, you'd really need to bring to bear upon the mystery, again, theoretical and mathematical frameworks to explain this potential phenomenon, but yeah, I mean, I like your mode of inquiry. Let's say, you know, consider the quantum and the distribution of density of let's say coherent waveforms that might linger between these universes. Sure.
I took a quick look at Macy's website, and it's weird.
Yeah, absolutely. Like I said, it almost typifies a peculiar type of psychopathology of a meticulously constructed fantasy that then has adherents coming in flocks. The hits are amazing, and why people continue to return after considering some of the quote-unquote evidence is beyond me.
I don't think he's been on this program before, at least not with me.
No, and I believe he was in 1990, I think he was on.
That was a long time ago.
Yeah, a long time ago.
Would you come on with him again if we got him?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I'm willing to bet he would not come on, but absolutely, I'm laying it on the table now. I'm open to a free and open exchange of ideas and factually based opinions. Sure.
That would be interesting. Okay. Let's go to Las Vegas, Nevada, where I'll be tomorrow. Sean, go ahead, Sean.
Hi, George, and
hi.
Your guest, Stephen, a very, very interesting show. From the part of the show that I was able to catch, I hear you talking about a device called a Spiracom. And I just say that, you know, from a marketing standpoint, that is such a cool name. And was this product or this item, was it going to be offered at some point for some kind of retail sale?
Yeah, well, you see, this is before viral marketing, but I agree, it's a pretty cool title.
It is a good title.
Yeah, we mentioned earlier that Alexander McCrae provides evidence that these devices were for sale for $10,000 apiece, but that hardly seems to be the primary motivation, although there was an operational budget of $250,000 per year with 1980s money, and all they have to show for it is essentially some devices that are modified sideband radios. So that in and of itself is quite interesting. It smells like a shell operation of some sort, like a CIA cutout, and that brings back in that whole Puharich piece, this guy who serves as a military officer at the U.S. Army Chemical Center and conducting LSD experiments and building voice-to-skull psychoacoustic devices where he's projecting voices into the minds of these people, you know. So was he doing the same with folks and organizations, bringing them, shepherding them to a given belief system? Was he developing a future spirituality based on occultic principles that could be easily influenced through technology later? I don't know, but those are interesting questions to ask, fraught with implications.
True.
Okay. Oh, go ahead, Sean. You're still with us.
Question?
Sure.
I mean, it seems very obvious if you're going to have some sort of device that may be able to communicate with the dead, but an obvious control from it would be is to have such a device and be able to range up through the frequencies and actually to be able to hear the thoughts of a living human being.
Ah, well, now you've touched on something that has been brought up in the popular literature. It's a really good point. And the whole issue of control in an experiment is very unpopular with the intuitive technology people in ITC. But yes, that would have been a helpful control. You know, beyond that, though, the idea of Spiritcom working for everyone is not even something that's proposed by ITC adherents. You know, William O'Neill was supposed to be so special and have this special psychic something, an undefined something about him as to complete a circuit between the living and the dead. This, of course, makes replicating it impossible, which then protects disconfirming the Spiritcom story, you see. So it's this built-in circuitous logic of that you find in a cult, really.
Yes, I see the truth in that.
Okay, good. Thanks, Sean. Gosh, we're almost out of time, Stephen. It's clicking by. As a matter of fact, we only have a minute left. So, you know, give us your website and how can people get information, more information on what you do?
Well, great. Yeah, I would like to collaborate with serious folks. I think we need to bring all this research to the peer review level, propose some best evidence standards and experimentation, some corroborative measures, try to take this to the next level by doing two things. One, discount the hokey stuff, which is just disproven so easily, and try to replicate that which is most interesting. And so people can find out all about this Spiritcom study and the related materials at spiritcomstudy.com. There's an email there, evpitc@yahoo.com. Again, serious inquiries only. And if folks have any primary source materials related to the case that might disprove what I'm saying, I promise I update my conclusions based upon new evidence.
I want to get you back, Stephen Rourke. For Karis Coburn, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Ladasur, Ross Mitchell, George Nappy, and Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.